Hello and welcome to another edition of Hearsay Culture. You're listening to KZSU Stanford University. My name is Dave Levine. I'm a resident fellow at the Center for Internet and Society at Stanford Law School. And I thank you for tuning in today to another edition of this Talk Technology and Law show, designed to bring people up to speed on all kinds of issues relating to those both of those fields, and hopefully the intersection of them. Today I'm very pleased to have on as a guest visiting assistant professor Elizabeth Townsend Gard from Seattle University, who's working on a very interesting study of the world of the public domain, and particularly examining the unpublished works that have suddenly and without much fanfare entered the public domain starting in 2003. You may wonder, as I outline that topic, why that's something that we would be interested in, a show involving technology and law. And the answer is, it gets back to the general issue of what we're doing with copyright law in the country and how copyright law itself both it helps and hinders the creation of new works, innovation, and really the sharing of knowledge. And what Elizabeth has been focusing on, the world of unpublished works, is really actually quite interesting and radically underexplored. Elizabeth is working on an article entitled Unpublished Works in the Public Domain, The Opening of a New Frontier. And I'm very excited to have her on today to discuss her research and kind of get an overview of the area and her thesis and what she's doing about it. Elizabeth has also been involved with podcasting and podcasting law. Earlier in the year, I had the pleasure of interviewing CIS non-resident fellow Colette Vogel. Elizabeth is also, among other things, a non-resident fellow at CIS and worked with Colette in the podcasting arena. And so towards the end of the show, I kind of want to talk to her a little bit about that and where we are with those issues. But the primary focus today is going to be on Elizabeth's groundbreaking research in the area of unpublished works in the public domain. So the theme of the show is unpublished works. For those of you listening today on KZSU and not listening to it on a podcast, I've tried to pick out some songs that deal with the idea of giving things away for free, sharing information, not paying for information, things like that. I do my best to find songs that match the theme of the show. It's sometimes it's difficult, sometimes it's hard. Certainly when I had David Olson on discussing patents, it was more of a challenge. But I think I've picked out a few today that you'll enjoy. So the first song there was Get What You Give by the New Radicals. We're going to come into another music break right now. And when we come back, I will bring Elizabeth on the air. You're listening to KZSU Stanford, Hearsay Culture, and Dave Levine. And if I've done my job and my responsibility correctly here today, I now have Elizabeth on the other end of the phone. Elizabeth, are you there?
Yes, I am.
Terrific. Thank you for joining me today on Hearsay Culture by telephone. Why don't we jump right in and start off with a question I always like to ask when we're dealing with interesting topics that are not directly in the public arena at a given moment. Tell us a little bit about how you came to this topic.
There's an echo. Is there an echo on your end? Okay. Sounds okay. Great. Oh, fabulous. Well, I'm very excited to be here. Let me just start with that, and I'm looking forward to our chat. I started let me back up. I have a PhD in European history, and when I was doing my work, I ran into a lot of problems in terms of the work that I wanted to do. I was working in biography, and there just happened to be a literary executor who was also working on the same topic that I was working on. And there were rumors that he was not giving permission to people, but just looking at your work. So when you turned in things to him, supposedly, as the story goes, he would look at your work and then either say yes or no to you, but take all the things that you had found. And I didn't really like that. So I looked around and I started to look about, and this was in the early 90s, and I started to look at fair use. And I found that fair use wasn't very helpful. And so I decided that after my PhD, after I completed my PhD to go to law school, while at law school in my copyright class, the copyright professor happened to mention that there was this new provision in Section 303A that allowed unpublished works to come into the public domain.
And that's now, Section 303A of the Copyright Act.
Of the Copyright Act, right. Now, this doesn't sound like a very exciting thing, but this was the most exciting thing I'd ever heard. Because what happens is, with Section 303A, unpublished works come into the public domain just like published works do, which means that at a certain point, you can use the works without asking a literary executor for any kind of permission. And so that was, like, super huge. Now, there's a lot of problems with that, and it's got life of the author plus 70 years, all kinds of issues. But instead of being protected perpetually, which it was before the 1976 Act, meaning that it was under state common law copyright, and that unless you published it, the work would stay under someone's control, now there was this whole new world of opportunity where scholars like me will potentially be able to use all kinds of materials without asking permission. And so that's where the work started, and now I'm, you know, many years into it, and it's extremely complex and extremely important, I would say, to sort of our world.
The world of the public domain is something that I think more and more people that focus on technology issues and on culture generally are familiar with.
Right.
But when we think about the public domain, I think most people think about published works.
Right.
For those that aren't familiar with the issue, why don't you just define for us what it means for a work to be published versus unpublished and the kind of things we're talking about?
Okay, first of all, that's a very good question and also a very difficult question. It's one of the questions that I talk about, but let's do it in a really simplistic way.
That'd be great.
First, what is a published work? We think about a published work as a Hemingway book, The Sun Also Rises, and you can go and get it at the library, or you can buy it, or you can download it. Published things are usually in multiple copies, and somebody has decided they want it out there in the stream of commerce. An unpublished work is something a bit different. Usually it's unique. Usually it's not been put out in the stream of commerce. And let me give you some examples.
Mm-hmm.
So there's a early, I'm going to give you a bunch. I'm going to give you some fancy ones and then some plain ones. So there was a Beethoven manuscript that was recently found in the last summer in Philadelphia. That manuscript had never been published, and scholars are super excited about it. That's an example. So it got lost before it was published. There was only one copy of it, and it was sold for over $1 million. So that's an unpublished work. Another one is there was a previously unknown Hemingway short story, a new Frost poem that was discovered. These are all sort of famous things. But unpublished works can also include things like your family photographs, letters, diaries, emails, instant messages, drafts of manuscripts, and then under the previous internal company memos and records, and under the previous Copyright Act, it also included motion pictures, television shows, and radio programs.
Hmm.
So it also, because of the way the Copyright Act is structured, it, as you know, and as your listeners know, that copyright arises automatically. It also means that when my daughter creates a painting, that has copyright and it's unpublished. So it's everything. It's a huge category.
Hmm. So publication, what we're talking about there essentially is the effort to commercialize or to somehow distribute the particular work. And are we talking about, just again, so I understand the sphere, we're talking about written works, correct? Or is it more than that?
It's everything. Everything that can be copyrighted. So it's artistic works. It's everything. It's
okay.
Music, obviously sound recordings. I don't know if your listeners know, but obviously sound recordings are under a different element because they have a whole bunch of stuff. But yeah, it's everything. It's
mm-hmm.
everything.
So you were talking about how you first came to the issue,
right.
And I'm curious again to set the stage for what we're talking about. Is this an area in your exploration that is getting more attention right now? I mean, your article, at least the draft that I have, suggests that there isn't a lot written about this. I'm curious.
Yeah.
So it isn't the case. Why do you think that is?
I don't know. I think it's kind of funny. I really thought, well, first of all, there's only two of us working on this topic, Tony Reset at Austin and myself, and he's got an article coming out in 2007. I've got a couple of articles coming out as well. But for some reason, it's been strangely overlooked, which is really interesting because we live in a culture that really wants materials. I mean, that was the Eldred case, right, that they were upset by freezing the public domain And here's a whole body of material that is now coming into the public domain, and people just haven't noticed yet. Archivists sort of know, but they don't even know that much. It's been this funny little hidden thing, and yet it was put into the 1976 Copyright Act, so there was plenty of time that people should know about it. And yet, and this stuff is valuable, and people are interested in it. I mean, think about, like, the Foley email and instant messaging. People like this unpublished work. Mm-hmm. It's often, like, the exciting part of things. And yet, there's just not much attention being paid to it yet. And yet, it's a huge, rich, vast resource of material.
Right. And it would seem to me also, perhaps, it has something to do with the fact that the unpublished works, perhaps for one reason or another, did not enter the stream of commerce in the way that, that published works would have.
Right.
And so perhaps there's maybe there's a value judgment made as to the relative worth of the unpublished work. I don't know.
Well, yeah, and I think there's also been, we have had such a long tradition of these works being protected perpetually until someone decides to publish it, that are, it's really ingrained into our society. So we don't really think, we think of it as a privacy thing, that these things shouldn't be able to be put on the internet because a copyright term has expired. So mm-hmm. it's just not part of our common culture yet. But it will be.
I suspect it will, and certainly, and we'll get into some of the details now. Certainly, your paper suggests that this is only going to be a greater and greater issue. So, the way that the law operates, well, why don't you describe that? In other words, I mentioned 2003 as being
right.
the important initial date, but why don't you tell us, the listeners, a little bit about what how this works and what happens right now in 2006.
Well, the 1976 Act fundamentally changed how we looked at copyright in terms of determining duration. We went from an author-based work, which meant that when you published a work, that was the date we used to determine how long the copyright would be, to an author-based, life plus the author-based system, which meant that we didn't care when the work was published or if it was published, that every work that someone creates is the life of the author plus 70 years. And with that change, unpublished works got brought into the federal system for the first time. Now, what this means is that they needed to make a transition period, because if the Copyright Act began, there'd be all these works that would fall into the public domain immediately because the authors would be dead for longer than 70 years. And so Section 303A serves as a transition period, and that's what my work looks at, is this transition period. And what Section 303A does, do you want me to tell you in detail what Section 303A
does? Yeah, actually, I think it would be useful
because it
really shows us how the law is changing right now and what the law has done to change the state of play right now.
Right. Okay, well, what Section 303 does is it sets out that no work will come out of copyright, no matter, regardless of how long the author had been dead, before December 31st, 2002. So no unpublished works came into the public domain until January 1st, 2003. That's why 2003 marks a really big moment. And, in fact, some archives and librarians did have really big parties. Like, they were very excited, and there was, you know, the big New Year's Day, but for most didn't really notice it. But it was big in some communities. So no works come out until December 31st, 2002. Now, there was a special provision that says that if you take these unpublished works that were created before the new Copyright Act, so before January 1st, 1978, then you get an additional term of protection if you publish it between 1978 and 2002.
Mm-hmm.
So this is very technical, but what it means is that if you, like the Mark Twain papers, they microfilmed all of the Mark Twain papers, and they now have copyright protection until December 31st, 2047. So they gave unpublished works that were the older unpublished works extra time and extra copyright protection, and gave them the incentive that if you publish it for the first time, you get more protection.
Hmm.
So what my work looks at is sort of, well, my initial question was, how many people took advantage of this extra protection, and what do we have now in the unpublished public domain?
Mm-hmm.
And my question turned into how difficult it is to determine what is in the unpublished public domain because of the lack of information and awareness. And so that's where my work sort of focused on, is the difficulty of really, I mean, this statute is very short and very small, this portion of the statute, but it is, has a lot of complexity to it, and it's not easy to understand.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's a very challenging issue. I mean, I've spent time trying to figure out what publication means just itself in the context of sound recordings.
Right.
And the level of detail that you need to get to figure out publication is really quite startling. So
yeah,
the draft that I've seen is very impressive in trying to get your hands around that issue. Yeah. It's probably at a level of detail that we don't need to get into today,
no.
perhaps mercifully.
Yeah.
But what I'd like to talk about now.
Before we move on, because I know your audience is a tech audience and a technology and law audience, and they may ask, like, why do we care and why do we need to know this?
There you go.
And I think that what it is, these are incredible resources, that there are database companies that are using them, there are people putting them up on the Internet. There's a lot of money to be made in these materials because people, usually you have to get a grant, go to an archive, look at these materials. It takes a lot of money and a lot of time, and it's only a specialty group. People who do this, here's an opportunity to put these all on the Internet and to put them into different forms.
Mm-hmm.
And so there is a lot of opportunity here in terms of using the technology we have to make them more available and to make money off of it. It's just that nobody really is doing, and there are a few companies that are doing it, but people just haven't, I mean, it's, you know, you think about the Gutenberg Project and Project Gutenberg and other places, the Internet Archive, that this is more of the stuff that they like.
Mm-hmm.
It's just in the unpublished version of it. And most of the stuff that we've seen has been published, stuff that's in the public domain. So there's just a lot of opportunity for growth, and it's with unpublished works.
Do you expect in the surveys that you've conducted and the stories that you tell in the paper, and I want to get into a couple of them, mm-hmm. do you get the sense that there is interest in to use the popular word right now, monetizing or commercializing works in the public domain, things that are coming out now. I mean, your paper runs through a number of examples throughout the paper, from the writings of famous authors to other film footage. You go through quite a lot of stuff. What's your sense, if you don't, I mean, I'm not suggesting you have empirical data, but what's your sense of that?
Well, I think that there's two things happening. I think that the people are using these unpublished works, that they're recognizing that they're unpublished or that they can use them without getting permission, but they're also claiming copyright on them themselves. So they're pretending that they actually, I mean, they're putting the copyright symbol on and they're pretending that they themselves now own this because they've put it into a new form and they've put it into a database. And so that's one of the things we need to protect against, is that we don't put a new spin on it, and we have these sort of pretend copyrights on material that are actually in the public domain. And that seems to be a big trend with this stuff, which, you know, it'll get worked out.
Mm-hmm.
But right now, since it's new, people don't really understand you can't do that.
Let me go through some of the paper and come back to that issue, because I think it's a very important one, and it really pulls us in the direction of what we mean with the public domain and in the direction of the commons theories that are being kicked around, and I want to get into that.
Right.
Let me ask this one question about the term publication, which I think is illuminating, and you talk about a bit in the paper, and I think it's one of those things about copyright law that's I think challenging and interesting. Why is it that publication is the touchstone for this analysis? In other words, why is it that we have a system of property rights where it is, you know, the actual offer of the material to the public that becomes the basis upon which we decide whether a property right should exist? What's your sense of that?
Well, I mean, that's the key, I think, and in some way that's sort of where my work's going next, is this notion of publication, because that touchstone, as you called it, was how the copyright system worked, that you get to keep it until it was the bargain. It was the copyright bargain. So before you publish something, when you create a drawing and you just keep it to yourselves and you put it in your drawer, you can do, no one's going to make you do anything with it. But once you've published it, the copyright bargain goes is that the federal government will protect you in a number of ways, including statutory damages and potentially attorney's fees. They'll give you some exclusive rights that only you can do. But in exchange for that, you donate your work to the public upon the expiration of the term. So it's like the patents, where you get a patent, but you also have to give up all the information about it so other people could make it once it expires. So
mm-hmm.
that was the way our system operated from the very, very beginning. and from the beginning, from the Statute of Anne, from England. So that it was all this sort of notion of publication. That's what got you into the federal system. But now that's all changed because it's now a civil law-based kind of concept of just it arises out of creation. So we don't have publication as a dividing line. I mean, we have it a little bit, but not in sort of the major ways that we had seen it before. And so that's one of the things that people haven't really started looking at in terms of like the theories and commons theories and public domain, people who work on public domain, is how do unpublished works coming into the system affect our notion of what it is to have a copyright and what copyright is, because it was always based on publication, and it's not anymore.
And you mentioned it, and I after the music break, I want to get into the issue of how we determine what is in the public domain, because that's another enormous question, and it touches in different areas. But you started getting into, and I want to probe a little bit, the internet element of this.
Right.
One of the challenges of the internet itself is that it's a medium that, you know, as many have described it, is dumb, in the sense that in order to access the internet, you basically have to have a piece of hardware. That piece of hardware doesn't judge the relative value of, or the merit or the worth of anything you put into it.
Right.
It's simply a network where the brains and the real thinking occurs at the ends. The internet itself, therefore, would seem to be to turn copyright law on its head, especially as it deals with publication. But I'm curious, in the unpublished works domain, whether the internet actually operates a slightly different way, in that it will encourage not only the use of the internet to create new works, but also simply the dissemination of knowledge that may have been locked in back doors.
Huge. I mean, it's huge. The idea that, I mean, that's the most exciting part of all this, is that people can potentially put up all of the first two ways. They can put up copyrighted materials, you know, legally or whatever, and then once it expires, it will be in the public domain and we can all use it. Or public domain works, that they can put them up and without any kind of worries or fears. And you think about all those archives and all that stuff out there, that if that was on the internet, I mean, how exciting. I mean, we see that with the Truman Library and the FDR. I mean, the presidential libraries often have a lot of money, so we see that with them first. But we see it all in all kinds of situations. We've got a lot of really interesting Civil War material that is up, and it's just great. I mean, it's just great. You can use these primary sources in all kinds of contexts that you wouldn't have been able to get at had it not been for the internet. So the possibilities are just beyond exciting.
Have there been efforts to challenge? I mean, let me take a step back. Mm-hmm. The law itself, as we know, and you talk about in the paper, the Sonny Bono Extension Act and other acts of Congress, signed by the president, have extended the duration of copyright. And you discussed in the paper, you discussed it at the beginning. It's curious that it doesn't appear like there has been, at least recently, by recently I mean in the last few years, an effort to somehow, as you were talking about in the paper, extend the term.
Right.
You have the safe harbor that you describe, where long as you publish the work during, you know, the relevant period, you'll get the extension. But it's a little surprising, perhaps, that there hasn't been more of an effort to just not let this happen in the first place.
Right. That was what was so interesting about it, is that in the midst of all the copyright term extension stuff, that they didn't extend the deadline. That I would have assumed that they would have, instead of 2002, it would have been 2022, that they had extended it 20 years, but they didn't.
Mm-hmm.
So we had the public domain, the unpublished works coming into the public domain in 2002, which I think was a big lobbying effort on. I wasn't part of it, but there was a big lobbying effort by historians and others to keep it at 2002.
So there was actually a lobbying effort going the other direction than we're used to.
To
actually not have copyright protection.
Right. I have to say that, you know, it isn't just historians or the elementary school kid using these materials, or documentary filmmakers or artists, but, you know, corporations also, you know, Disney has, you know, Peter Pan. I mean, they have to pay royalties on, you know, Peter Pan until that's in the public domain. So, I mean, it's in the best interest for lots of people to have works in the public domain, because then they become more freely accessible and unencumbered. So it's good for everyone, this public domain stuff.
Mm-hmm.
And sometimes we think of it as sort of not that way.
Well, let's. I want to press you a little on some of the good versus potential bad of unpublished works entering the public domain after the music break, and then talk about this enormous challenge involving the lack of affirmative registration of this work, and therefore the reason why it's considered unpublished under the law.
Right.
So when we return, we're talking to Elizabeth Townsend-Gard, a visiting assistant professor at Seattle University and a Center for Internet and Society non-resident fellow, on a world of the public domain. You're listening to KZSU Stanford. Before we get back to Elizabeth, I want to do what I've done every week for the last multiple weeks and ask you the question that you can't answer to me directly, or I want to hear the answer right now. Do you like what you're hearing? Help make sure that KZSU can continue to provide great programs without commercials to listeners all over the Bay Area, and indeed on the Internet all over the world. Please donate to KZSU. That's right, I'm asking for money again. For more information, email our underwriting department at underwriting@kzsu.stanford.edu. And don't forget to keep on listening. So we're back with Elizabeth, and I hope you enjoyed the music break. And let's talk now a little bit about what you were getting into with the public domain and the kind of information that's out there. The challenge that we have, among other things, is identifying what's in the public domain. Why don't you tell me a little bit about that issue?
Okay, great. Well, what I thought I might do for your listeners is to give them a really basic element information about the unpublished works. So the way the law works is that anything that is unpublished of someone who is now deceased before 1936 and has not been published is in the public domain. And every year from now on, anyone who died before 1936 and has unpublished materials, those materials are in the public domain.
Okay.
That's a huge amount of material. Now there's one extra component. Because of the way the copyright law is written about unpublished works in the U.S. in the 1976 Copyright Act, this is international in scope, which means that it's anybody who has been deceased before 1936 worldwide.
Hmm.
So that's a lot of stuff. Now, you have to use it in the U.S. because, you know, that's the way copyright law works. But that means that if you are somebody who wants to use something from Australia or from Brazil and the author has been dead longer than 1935 or before, and it's unpublished, it's in the public domain in the U.S. You don't need to get permission from a copyright holder to use that material for anything. In the United States.
Mm-hmm.
Right. That's huge. That's a huge amount of material.
Yeah. And when we're talking about the identifying that stuff, you know, what it reminded me of is the entire orphan works issue,
right,
that many people have written about, Chris Sprigman, among others.
Right.
How does that touch on the problems that you address when you're entering the unpublished realm?
Well, it's huge because we have to know when the author died.
Mm-hmm.
And oftentimes when you have a photograph or a letter, you don't know where this person is, when they died, what to do, and then you are in sort of a pickle in some way. So I use an example in the paper of someone I work on who is a World War One, a boy who goes off to World War One and dies in 1917. Well, if you don't know that he dies, the Copyright Office has this thing where you can write to them, and there's like 120 years later, they'll presume that the person is dead from the time of creation. Well, that's a big difference between 120 years versus being in the public domain now.
Mm-hmm.
So you get a lot of problems of sort of, you can't use something unless you kind of know someone when they die.
Does that make the issue itself less monumental in the sense that if people are going to be concerned that the information they choose to use may or may not be in the public domain, and they have no way of figuring it out, that they may opt against using it. Alternatively, it kind of lends the question, sort of two-part question, which is, are you aware of or have you heard of anyone challenging works in the public domain since 2003 when the changes started happening?
No, I haven't heard of anything. Nobody seems to be noticing. So, no, I haven't heard of any of that. You know, I don't know. I mean, I think that your other question about, will it keep people from using the material? Well, they're not really using it because they know about this to begin with, so it would have to sort of become known and then have sort of a backlash to it. But I think what it does is it gives more materials possibility of being used. So, for instance, on the work that I do, I work on a woman named Vera Brittain, and she, and this is one of the many people I work on. So, and so her work, she died in 1970, so her work is not going to be into the public domain until 1970 plus 40 years, which is 2040. Mm-hmm. But her brothers died in 1918, and so some of the stuff has been published. I would need to get permission to use that part, that stuff that's been published, so they've gotten additional protection just the way it's supposed to work until 2047. But the stuff they didn't publish, this unpublished material, I can use freely. So if they haven't published part of a letter, I can use the unpublished portion. So in some way, it's an incentive for scholars, artists, documentary filmmakers to use the stuff that's the discarded stuff. And sometimes that stuff's the really cool stuff, you know, that, and so it brings more into our culture, and it encourages people to use material.
So there, I could see a privacy argument against this being a good thing.
Yes.
And let me throw that out there and get your reaction to it. So okay. The privacy argument goes something like this. You know, if there's an individual or an artist or what have you who has unpublished writings,
right.
It's possible that that individual chose not to publish it for any number of reasons.
Right.
But let's assume for my hypothetical that the reason is something quite embarrassing about the individual. They didn't publish it. They passed away. Their estate didn't really notice it, pay attention. And then quietly in 2003, suddenly that information is now public.
Right.
Is there an argument that, and the law is what the law is, but I'm curious, is there an argument that the law may have actually missed an opportunity to properly use copyright law to protect the privacy of these individuals? Is there anything to that?
Give me an example. What do you mean?
Well,
by that?
If you have, let's say you have an author who, you know, passed away, you know, during the relevant time period, but
right.
towards the early part of the century.
Mm-hmm.
And that author or that writer had written something about one of their, I'm just making this up, but wrote something about one of their pieces of work or a piece of art and said they really didn't care for it, didn't think it was very good, and would have preferred that it be destroyed. And that writing suddenly, you know, that author, that artist or that musician, what have you, locked it away in a box and somehow it's made its way into the public domain. Someone got their hands on it.
Right.
You know, I could put aside, we could come up with a whole kind of stories about how it comes into someone's
right.
hands. But let's assume it's legitimate means.
Okay.
So here we are now with this particular creator having perhaps chosen at that time to keep that information private, or at least within a small group. It's suddenly thrust into public domain and it could be used for, you know, in any possible way,
right.
scholarly or otherwise.
Right.
Is there a privacy issue there, do you
Absolutely.
Think?
Absolutely. I mean, I think that, I mean, I'm beyond thrilled that this is happening, but it is a bit alarming that suddenly your family materials can be, anybody can use it. I mean, it goes against everything we've ever thought about with copyright and unpublished works. And then there's a lot of mechanisms that sort of protect that in some way. So if so obviously you can just keep it from people. So keep it in the attic or worse, destroy it. I think it actually encourages people to destroy materials, which isn't very good. But I think the other thing is contract and access controls. So if you donate your materials to a library, you can still have a contract or conditional access controls. That hasn't gone away.
Mm-hmm.
And some people even say that maybe there isn't an unpublished public domain after all, because if you can contract around it, then nothing is in the public domain. So
right.
I donate my papers to Seattle University, and I say, but no one, you know, you may look at them, but no one may ever publish them.
Mm-hmm.
And so the copyright term expires. Does that contract still... Is that still a valid contract? And if so, then that sort of keeps people, the privacy interest is still there.
Mm-hmm.
So I don't know.
I think it's one of those normative questions. I mean, certainly for me personally, you know, I agree with everything you're saying about how valuable these resources are. But privacy is often an issue that comes up when people are discussing unpublished works, especially.
Right. Well,
Let me, in the time that we have left, I kind of want to, and you started talking about it. So, you know, your article is exhaustive in talking about the issues and also talking about potential solutions. So to the issue of the, you know, the unpublished works and figuring out when the author died and where the work is, what solutions do you suggest in your article?
Well, I think that it comes down to the archivists and the people, the gatekeepers and the people who hold these materials. They've never had to know the death dates of the authors of the materials because it wasn't an issue. And I think that it's a new thing that needs to be part of the cataloging process, so that they have that as part of the information. When you go finding aid is a document that archivists create that tell you what's in the collection. And so when you go to these finding aids that are often on the internet, having whether a work has been published and having whether in terms of the transition period, but more importantly, having whether the author has died is huge. And so it's a change in culture and a change in what we're sort of expecting as a public when we look at these records.
And where do you think we're headed? I mean, do you think that we're going to continue to have the unfettered, unpublished public domain continue?
No, I don't know. That's a big question. What do you think about that, David?
I'm skeptical.
Yeah.
My own opinion is that as we sit here today, there's certainly strong efforts to strengthen copyright law, and the public domain is often the battleground. I do think that the unpublished nature of the works that you're describing, it creates very different incentives. And I frankly think
different incentives in what way?
Different incentives, and I like how you turn to tables. This is fun though.
Yeah.
different incentives, in the sense that when we have published works, getting back to the traditional bases upon which intellectual property derives its currency,
uh-huh.
It boils down to the idea of capturing the economic value of your work.
Right.
And publication has been the traditional means by which authors have been able to do that.
Right.
So you have much more of an argument that says, hey, I've tried to make money off of this, so it shouldn't be in the public domain. And that's the battle involving fair use, which I've discussed with other people and which is, tangential to our discussion today.
Right.
The unpublished nature of this, however, I think is a very different incentive structure. The idea that no one published in the legal sense the work such that that particular item, that particular creation, was not commercialized, there wasn't an effort to capture its value, means to me that there's less of a reason to have any kind of copyright protection. What are we encouraging by giving it those rights? So I think
I think that's interesting. The other thing I think is that we may be losing the notion of what you were talking about with privacy and instead replacing it only with economics.
Mm-hmm.
That if we see these unpublished works as just purely economic, it's pretty interesting that we've made that such a substantial shift. And I don't know if that was the intention of Section 303A, but it seems to be the case.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
That you can exploit them as an economic, but you don't have any privacy rights anymore.
Right. And I would suspect that as, as you were suggesting, as works that are unpublished enter the public domain and individuals attempt to make money off of them, I'm putting aside scholarly works that might sell books, but I'm thinking more in terms of just, what people consider to be, less of a public interest and more of a private interest type work, that there, I could envision someone standing up and saying that the law is wrong. Now it wouldn't, obviously we don't do ex post facto laws. We don't pass laws generally that say, okay, what was legal when you did it is now illegal.
Right.
But I could see someone trying to make a stand on this and make the argument. I think at the end of the day, it's not a great argument. I certainly would hope that it would not be successful, because I'm a firm believer in the intellectual commons, and I ascribe to the view that the commons is the basic way upon which we build societies and we share information and we innovate and we create and we improve. But I could see someone making the argument the other way. So it's a challenging issue. And I think, I at the beginning, and I continue to say, I think it's a great article. What's its status at this time?
It's currently under review.
Okay, excellent. Well, you know, I guess if there happen to be any law review editors listening right now, I certainly would lend my support to publishing this piece of work. Is it a
There's a shorter version actually coming out at Cardoza Arts and Entertainment Law. That's sort of the basics of sort of what the law, the change is, and then sort of how the international implications of that. And that should be out in November.
Terrific.
This is just a bigger piece that's more sort of deeper theoretical kind of.
Is the draft available if anyone would like to take a look at it?
Yeah, I'll put it up on SSRN. I don't think I've put it up yet, so I'll put it up.
Okay, so that's SSRN.com.
Yeah.
Which is, for those who aren't familiar, is a great resource for looking at drafts of articles and even some published articles. Well, Elizabeth, this is a great talk. Before, we end our conversation today, I do want to touch, briefly on the podcasting issues. And maybe just my ultimate question is there any latest, any new things happening right now in the world of podcasting in the last, you know, 3 or 4 months that you think are things that the listeners would be interested in?
Well, I don't know. I mean, Colette, as you know, as your listeners probably know, Colette is like the person to go to on podcasting. And we had a delightful – I was in London last year, and we had a fabulous week where she came to visit, and we got really immersed in talking about podcasting. And so I've been interested in sort of the higher ed elements of podcasting. And so we've got a piece coming out on that, on higher ed and corporations, and sort of the title part of it is Look Before You Leap, because we both have been finding that corporations and higher ed institutions are putting up podcasts like crazy, but they're not really looking at the legal implications of this. So in my work, I look at what happens when you podcast a traditional classroom. Because under the Copyright Act, we get some special things when you're in the classroom. You can show a movie, you can do a poem, you know, all these special things under 110.1. But what happens when you record that classroom? The other part about it that's a little more troubling is that teachers have had some special place that's called the teacher exception, where the work you do is your own in your classroom. And when the university or the high school starts taping your classroom, how does that change the ownership structure of that material? Is there an economic interest to suddenly make the ownership the university owns your lecture? And if it does, what does that mean when you go to a different place? So I think that and then of course there's the freedom, the academic freedom issues and the government issues. Will you be required to turn, as an institution, required to turn over materials of these podcasted lectures? Will you have the choice to have your classroom taped or not? I mean, I think that there's a lot of huge questions that we need to look at. And I'm a little bit on the unpublished public domain side, I jump in with both feet. On this one, I'm a little bit more cautious because I think there are bigger implications.
Yeah, that's another battleground. It sounds to me like the theme of the work you're doing really does focus on scholarly activities. Am I right about that?
Yes, definitely. I'm working on a book called Copyright in a Scholar's Work, which looks at all kinds of issues in a scholarly context. Well, but those issues touch upon everybody. I mean, they're the same issues that the Center for Social Media does with documentary filmmakers. And, I mean, we all use and create materials, particularly in a non-commercial sense. We all have the same issues. It's quite amazing.
It is. And, you know, I think in closing, I think that the work that you're doing here needs to be done. And I wish you much success in placing the article in a law review and in continuing the work. And I'd like to invite you back at a later date to discuss the book that you're working on, because I agree with you that, you know, even in the context of because of technology and particularly the internet's ability to disseminate information far and wide, the kind of work you're doing perhaps 30 years ago would have been viewed as more narrow than it is today. And
right.
The fact is that anyone can engage in scholarship at different levels and disseminate their work free of charge,
right.
Generally through the internet. And SSRN is actually a for-profit, I believe, operation,
right.
But it's the same concept where people are able to put drafts up on the internet, which can be downloaded simply by going to the web page, as opposed to the past where you'd have to write letters and then just made it more cumbersome. So it's great work. Well, I want to thank you for being on today.
Well, thank you, David. This has been super fun.
I'm glad you enjoyed it. And when we return from a short music break, I'm going to wrap up the show, and we'll be closing the show. So, Elizabeth, thank you again.
Thanks.
I want to thank Professor Elizabeth Townsend Gard from Seattle University for being on the show today and discussing her work involving the unpublished world and the public domain, using my own euphemism. But again, just for anyone that's interested in finding the article, the title of the article is Unpublished Works in the Public Domain, The Opening of a New Frontier, by Elizabeth Townsend Gard. I'm very excited to tell you that I have some great guests coming up in the coming few months. Just by way of what's coming up in the next few weeks, next week I'll be interviewing Professor Alistair Roberts from Syracuse University involving his book Blacked Out: Government Secrecy in the Information Age. I will also have on as a guest Alyssa Hecker, who, among other things, was a former assistant general counsel at the Harry Fox Agency, to kind of have a bit of a debate involving copyright law and fair use. So I'm looking forward to that. And other authors are on their way as well. I'm going to put a posting up on my blog, hopefully today, that will lay out the schedule for the coming few months. You can find the blog at cyberlaw.stanford.edu, which is the Center for Internet and Society's webpage, where you can also find information about everything going on at the center, as well as the blogs of many people, including Elizabeth's, who is a non-resident fellow at CIS. And I've become a broken record on this, and I'm starting to get some jokes from people about it. I keep saying, "Oh, my webpage is on the way," but it really is. And I found, as I learned the world of coding web pages, that it's far more challenging, like so many things are, than it looks. But my goal is to have the page live and operational and even beta tested by the end of the month. And that's a hard deadline that I'm setting for myself. So I appreciate everyone's patience, as I've said this week after week, that the web page is coming. But it really is. And I'm just trying to make it as user-friendly as I can with my rudimentary lawyer knowledge of web page design. So I will have that up very soon. So thank you for listening today. Stay tuned for Mike as we return to the wonderful music programming that KZSU runs every day. You can find my show, Hearsay Culture, from 5 to 6 p.m. Pacific Standard Time on KZSU every Wednesday. You can also find the show on the iTunes webpage for the Center for Internet and Society. And very soon you'll find it on my much ballyhooed, but so far not public, webpage for Hearsay Culture, the radio show on KZSU. My name is Dave Levine. Thank you for listening today, and I'll look forward to talking to you next week.